Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week we're going to be taking a look at J.J. Abrams' 2009 reboot of the Star Trek franchise, simply called Star Trek. Let's get into some background about Star Trek. This goes back a ways, actually. This is interesting how this film gestated. As early as 1968 at Worldcon, Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry had said he was going to make a film prequel to the TV series, which is kind of interesting. But the prequel concept did not resurface until the late 80s, when Ralph Winter and Harv Bennett submitted a proposal for a prequel during development of Star Trek IV. Roddenberry rejected Bennett's prequel proposal in 91 after the completion of The Final Frontier. Then a guy named David Lowery wrote a script entitled The Academy Years, but it was shelved, again, in light of objections from Roddenberry and all the fans who wanted more original series cast. And instead they went ahead with Star Trek VI, Undiscovered Country. We jumped to February 2005 after Nemesis kind of tanked and Enterprise was canceled after four seasons. Rick Berman and screenwriter Eric Jenderson began developing a new film entitled Star Trek The Beginning. And it was going to revolve around a new set of characters led by Kirk's ancestor named Tiberius Chase, kind of funny, beset during the Earth-Romulan War after the events of Enterprise, but before the events of the original series, so they were going to kind of, you know, keep it in that earlier timeline. In 2005, Viacom, which owned Paramount, separated from CBS, which retained Paramount's TV properties, including ownership of the Trek brand. Gail Berman, then president of Paramount, convinced CBS's chief executive, Leslie Moonves, to allow them 18 months to develop a new Star Trek film before CBS would re-earn the rights to develop a new TV series. And in return, CBS would keep merchandising rights. So Berman approached writers Orci and Kurtzman, who had just recently done Mission Impossible 3, for ideas on the new film. And after Mission Impossible 3 had completed shooting, she asked Abrams to produce it. So Abrams, Orci, and Kurtzman, plus producers Damon Lindelof and Brian Burke, lots of chefs in the kitchen on this one, felt the franchise had explored enough of what took place after the series. Orci and Lindelof considered themselves Trekkies and felt some of the Star Trek novels have had canonical value as well, although Roddenberry never considered the novels to be canon. In terms of the writing crew, Kurtzman said he was a casual fan, while Burke was not. In an interview, Abrams said that he hadn't seen Nemesis because he felt the franchise had disconnected from the original series. For him, he said, Trek was about Kirk and Spock, and the other series were like, quote, separate space adventures with the name Star Trek, end quote. And he also acknowledged as a child he had actually preferred the Star Wars movies. He noted that his general knowledge of Trek made him well-suited to introduce the franchise to newcomers and that being an optimistic person, he would make Star Trek an optimistic film, which would be a refreshing contrast to the darkened landscape of, you know, Nolan's Dark Knight, which was happening at that time. You know, definitely the whole Star Wars, Star Trek thing for Abrams, even watching Star Trek and even more Into Darkness, to me, Abrams really, like, I could tell. And when he was announced to become the Episode 7 director, to me, it was like a no-brainer because I felt like, in a weird way, Into Darkness was sort of his audition tape for Star Wars. So it makes total sense that he was more of a Star Wars fan because, to me, the movies feel more Star Wars-ish than Trek, which I'll get into as I go. So on February 2007, Abrams accepts Paramount's offer to direct the film after having been initially attached solely as producer. And he stated later after reading this, you know, he decided to direct the film because after reading the script, he realized he'd be very envious of anyone who stepped in and directed the movie, which is something he's been saying about Episode 8 as well, that he's regretting that he didn't take the reins because he thinks the script is really terrific. So it's kind of interesting to see the parallels here. Roberto Orci said getting Nimoy in the film was important to the production team. And he says, quote, having him sit around a campfire sharing his memories was never going to cut it. So, you know, what's really interesting about this movie is that they use time travel as a story device, but also as a franchise splitter as well, which I think is genius, where they're allowed to, you know, play in the same timeline as the original series and not have to play by any of the rules, but they can use situations and characters as they see fit. So, pretty genius way of rebooting a franchise, which leaves the original universe, that timeline intact, but can steal from it at will. So kind of genius. So Trek was released in 2009 to very favorable reviews. It currently has a 95% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and it did really well financially. So Abrams crafted himself quite a hit. All right, so let's jump into the film. So we start out this Trek film with credits, the brief opening credits. And the one thing that I noticed right away is there's a new theme. So they came up with new theme music. And you don't hear the old Alexander Courage stuff until the end of the movie when Nimoy does his bit of voiceover. So it's kind of interesting. But it's really good. It's a great rising theme in minor key that I really like. So I think it's a solid solid set of themes for the film that are brought back in and out. I think they also are in Into Darkness. So I really like the soundtrack cues and the music in the film. Definitely lends to it being like a, you know, a pretty epic sci-fi adventure. There's this great opening shot where the camera starts out like really close to the USS Kelvin's hull, and we're running pretty quick along it, you know, like as if we were flying really, really close. And then it pulls away, and we see the USS Kelvin, which is a cool, you know, ship, which is a different configuration than the normal cruiser class, you know, that the cruisers have the two nacelles in the back and the saucer. Kelvin's got like one nacelle and then like a nacelle-shaped kind of hull above that nacelle. So it's kind of cool. You know, it's always cool to see different configuration starships. Great visual. And immediately, you know, the ship is so large in the screen. And I think something that Abrams was able to achieve in this movie that he didn't get, I think, it didn't happen in Into Darkness, was he really paid attention to how big stuff was in the screen. To me, everything is so epic in these shots, especially in the opening shots. So then we get right into the bridge. There's lots of Dutch angles, so the camera is canted sideways, and there's, you know, tons of lens flare. And we see the Romulan ship, the Narada, coming out of the wormhole that it created. It's sort of perched right in front of the Kelvin, and we see, you know, initially we see how large the Kelvin is, and then the Kelvin sort of shrinks as it moves towards the Narada, and then we see the Narada. So there's a great sort of scale happening here where we realize that the Narada is like this massive ship. And great camera work on the bridge. The camera is like always moving. I feel like there's a lot of Michael Bay-isms in this film, and I mean that as a compliment, where Abrams keeps an actor in the foreground and then spins the camera. So we see stuff moving around behind the actors in the back, and it gives the scenes this really great sense of motion and vitality, you know. And so it starts right off that way, which is really neat. So lots of movement, lots of close-ups, and then we're full-on explosions as the Narada opens up on the Kelvin, and the ship gets hammered, and the effects are really terrific. One great thing that he also does, which I love, is, you know, a lot of times when we have space adventures, to not confuse the audience, the directors pretty much keep things level. You know, they pretty much keep ships that meet each other are in the same orientation. You know, we don't really get this sense of vertiginousness in space. But Abrams right away blows open three dimensions, and we get all kinds of great shots from, you know, what would be, quote, under a ship or over a ship and how it's moving. And I really feel like he's breaking open movement in a space adventure, and he does this in a bunch of different shots. With planets as well, where we never know where stuff's coming from. And it's really kind of, for me, it was a great way to kind of open up space in a space adventure film. You know, it really made it feel like just space was this very chaotic place where things could go and come in at any angle and any orientation. So he does a really great job there. You know, we have these great action scenes, and there's one shot which I really like where we follow a crewman inside the Kelvin, and then a hole is ripped in the ship, and the crewman is pulled out, and the camera follows the crewman, and once we clear the ship, all sound dies, as it would in space, since sound waves, you know, can't be carried in a vacuum. So I love that. It was a great effect. It reminded me of, I think it was Attack of the Clones, when Jango Fett was, you know, dropping mines and Obi-Wan was following him. Right before the mines would detonate, there would be this moment of silence where everything in the film would completely go down to nothing. And then we'd have the explosion. So I feel like it's cool, you know, when you have a huge motion picture where sound and movement and everything's going crazy. You have this moment where all of a sudden everything stops. And it's almost more powerful than the action itself. So I can't say enough about this opening sequence. It's just so great. And also, the diversity of the cast of the ship is wonderful. We see, you know, aged people, a guy with, you know, balding with a little crown. There's all kinds of aliens, people of color. Like, it's great. You know, it's multicultural with humans, but it's also, like, multicultural with aliens as well. And they're all shot really well as, you know, one kind of, I think it's a cyborg. It's got, like, these blue eyes. It looks kind of like he's half man, half machine. There's a guy with a strange head and a woman with the eyeballs that are a little canted and larger. So just kind of subtle but really cool aliens sprinkled throughout the ship, which I really like. And of course, you know, then we see Thor himself, Chris Hemsworth playing George Kirk. So basically the plot kicks in where, you know, they don't destroy the Kelvin. They want the captain to come aboard the Narada to negotiate, you know, peace, whatever. So the main captain leaves Kirk, who I guess was the first officer, in charge. So George Kirk is now in charge of the Enterprise. And the captain himself, you know, heads out to the Narada to, quote, negotiate. And again, we do this thing with scale as the... you know, the shuttle's a pretty decent-sized ship, but we see it exit the Kelvin and then head towards the Narada, and things are just larger by comparison, and we see how big the bloody thing is, you know? And so they're monitoring the captain's vital signs, you know, back on the ship. Everything's focused on this captain going over to the Narada, and the interior of the Romulan ship is amazing. It doesn't even look like the insides of a ship. It looks like, you know, kind of cavern somewhere, and things drop off to nothing, and there's a lot of platforms. Not what you would expect as the inside of a ship. It's like a mountain lair, I was thinking, more than a ship interior, which is very cool. So then we get the plot kickoff, and Nero's second in command shows the captain of the Kelvin a holo of a small ship, which is a very cool-looking ship, kind of with a spinning rear. And he's asking him, have you ever seen the ship? And then he throws up a hologram of Leonard Nimoy as old Spock, which is like, whoa, you know, we're right into the mix that somehow that Nimoy's going to be in this film. Like, that was kind of a cool way to kick things off, I thought. And we find out that they've come too early because they ask the captain of the Kelvin what the star date is. And then Nero is like enraged and he jumps up and spears them right in the chest. What we see is we cut back to the Kelvin and we see the captain's body signs and it says life signs terminated. And immediately the Kelvin's under attack again. So we get, you know, much more action and destruction yet again like before. And now we get the escalation of the personal. Like JJ does a great job of making a lot of things that happen in this film very personal to the characters, which is one of the reasons why I think the film works really well. And so, you know, we need this scene to kick off the story, but we're also kicking off the character of Kirk. And at the same time, there's this great drama happening where, you know, George Kirk's wife is in labor while he is trying to fend off this attack. And, you know, they're wheeling her to the shuttle and she's like, the baby's coming. It's a little melodramatic. I will say that, you know, Abrams can be a little soapy at times. But again, it works to me. Hemsworth is really great here. He's going to join them in the shuttle and autopilot the ship on a destruct course towards the Narada. And of course, the autopilot's broken. So he has to stay on the bridge to protect all these shuttles from, you know, the weapons of the Narada so that they can get away. And so we have these cutbacks to him on the ship, clearing the bridge and getting everybody off the ship and his wife screaming in labor. And then we go briefly into a montage. So the sound kind of drops away and we get a very kind of tragic soundtrack cue that comes up and we're watching the ship and what's happening. And we see Kirk being, you know, being born, and it's really good. Like, I really like it. And then George and his wife have this brief conversation about the name. He's asking, like, how does he look? And, or how does the baby look? Is it a boy or a girl? It's a boy. What should we name him? And she says Tiberius, and he's like, Tiberius. No, she says, let's name him after your father. And he's like, Tiberius, that's a terrible name, which is just very, you know, great fobs to the fans. And they name him Jim, and it's great. Then we back off, and the Kelvin disintegrates and, you know, drives it into the Narada. And we see the explosion is pretty intense as the warp core ruptures and the Narada gets hit. And all the other ships are able to escape in this long shot. We see them kind of trailing away from the Narada, which has been disabled. So, and then we're out and like, man, what an opening. You know, I was really, even when I was in the film, I was really impressed that we're kicking off the plot. We're kicking off the beginning, really, of Kirk's character and this theme of what his father did and how he was born and so on and so forth. You know, not only does it lead into his character, but it also is part of the plot. And it's kind of meta in that it's what the writers are doing to the story. Like, in this moment, the Star Trek universe has now changed forever, and Kirk is there, you know, at the birth of it, which is kind of neat. So I can't say enough great things about how this movie starts. So we cut immediately to Iowa, and we see, you know, James Tiberius Kirk as a, like, probably a 10, 12-year-old kid, and he's, you know, zooming through the desert in some kind of hot rod car from our time. And a brief conversation on the car communication device that it's his stepfather's dad. He took the car without permission. His mom has been off planet. So we get, you know, we get a brief bit of character here in that, you know, Kirk's kind of a wild kid. His mom's gone. Him and his stepdad, really contentious relationship. And he kind of does his own thing, and he's kind of a mess already. And then there's the moment where he pushes the button for the radio, and we get the Beastie Boys. The Sabotage comes cranking through. And it was something very fun about this. I remember seeing the trailer when the first time the trailer came out. And the Beastie Boys were in the trailer, and I thought, wow, it's kind of interesting they're using, you know, contemporary, you know, pop or rock music for Star Trek. It's so, such a weird juxtaposition. And I thought it was just kind of for the trailer. So I was kind of really surprised when the scene came and it really was in the scene. But it works. I don't know. It was really weird. You know, I thought to myself, Star Trek is always so scrubbed up and sci-fi looking that to have this young kid in a car, you know, in the desert, racing along with this music. I don't know. It was just a nice scene that I wouldn't have expected. So I did like it, even though part of me immediately bridled, like, hey, you know, what are you doing? It's rock and Star Trek. Hold on. You know, like the first time I heard the theme song to Enterprise TV show, you know, wailed in horror. Not that I ever came to love it, but any kind of change like that to a beloved franchise, you're like, wait a minute. But I thought it worked. I don't know. I liked it. And then we get this flying cop in this kind of odd mask who comes after him. And it's, again, it's like JJ, it's a bit over the top where, you know, Kirk takes the car all the way to the edge of the cliff. The car goes over the cliff and he scrabbles to the very edge of the cliff and holds on, you know, and then comes back up. And it's ridiculously over the top. But I think he was filming a bunch of stuff in IMAX. So there's a lot of recurring scenes of people falling off cliffs. And these vertical scenes where you see things drop. And I think those were there to sort of, you know, heighten the fact that those scenes were being shot in IMAX. So I haven't seen the film in IMAX. I'd imagine they were amazing shots for use of that format, you know, where you can really expand your sense of a film when you shoot in IMAX. So, but it's ridiculous with little 10-year-old Kirk almost, you know, going off the cliff. You know, it serves his character. The Kirk's a bit reckless. He's a bit headstrong, and he comes from kind of a broken home. His dad's dead. So, again, character setup, you know, which is kind of cool. And then we cut over to, you know, the character setup for both Kirk and Spock is so great here because it's so integral to the story. And I think it's another reason why I think this movie works so well, that you've spent so much of the early part of the movie really setting up character. So now we're on Vulcan. There's this beautiful architecture of Vulcan. I mean, the camera's kind of Dutch angled and canted, but the architecture is amazing on Vulcan, whatever major city we're at. When we first come upon it, just really beautiful and you know, right away, like non-Earth. You know, there's something exotic about it that I thought, oh, this isn't Earth. So it was kind of cool. JJ does this thing where when we, you know, there's a title card that says Vulcan and we see the planet from orbit. And, you know, you just get, as a sci-fi fan, you just get used to certain shots, right? I mean, certain planet shots, usually the bulk of the planet is in the below the screen. And the curve is kind of near the top of the screen. And in the very top of the screen is like space. Or, you know, a little bit to one side or the other side. And he does it where the planet actually fills the top two-thirds of the screen. And the curve of the planet and, you know, where you would be in orbit is below. And I thought, you know, not anything anyone's going to mention, but a very subtle touch to keep you off balance about when you're setting up shots, you know, you're not setting up this static, boring universe. Like, he's really concerned about where the camera is and where things are in the camera. Again, something which I think he really lost in Into Darkness. It was such a conventionally shot movie, and it felt it from the get-go. But this movie, really, just wonderful how things are coming in and out of the screen, and they continue to do so. So, again, a great character moment for Spock. He's learning, and I guess, you know, how they teach young Vulcan children is they stand in these little depressions and just continuously learn. And there's a great moment when these, and he's, again, he's like the same age as Kirk. A couple of kids come over, other Vulcan kids, and it's a great line. It's like, I'm assuming you've prepared more insults for today. Affirmative, you know, and they start mocking him. And basically, he's getting hammered for being half-human. So this begins the use of his mother as this trigger for a lot of his behavior. So one of the kids is like, you know, the human whore, and he flips out. and starts beating the crap out of the kid, takes him down. He's a smaller than the kid, but like gets the better of him, really loses his shit. And then there's this wonderful scene later with his dad. They're talking about, you're a person of two worlds, and it's going to be up to you which path you choose. And we set up a line at the end of the movie here where the father says, Spock is asking his dad, why did you marry her? And it's like, she's from Earth, we're from Vulcan. It was a logical choice, you know, the blending of the two cultures. So, you know, his father kind of at this point really resting on the side of the Vulcan way and logic being, you know, more preferable to his human side. So then we cut immediately to him, you know, he's in his very late teens, I guess graduating from, you know, whatever initial schooling that the Vulcans gave. And there's a scene with Winona Ryder, who plays Spock's mother, who's amazing. I like her in this. She doesn't have much to do, but she's very sympathetic. And she really does a great job of giving us the sense that she really dotes on Spock. And the fact that Spock is trying to suppress his emotions for her, and she knows this and doesn't care, like there's something sweet about that as they're in the screen together, you know? So he's, you know, he kind of feels bad that he's like, look, I'm going to choose the Kolinar, which will purge all emotions, which, so they use the Kolinar ritual, which is something that we, I think, learned about only in the original, the first original series film when Spock tries to do Kolinar and he senses V'ger and bails. He also applied to Starfleet as a backup, but that, you know, at this point, he thinks he's going to join the Vulcan Science Academy and, you know, purge all his emotions. And he wants his mother to know that it's not a reflection on her, you know, which is a very sweet scene. And he's very protective of her, you know. And so there's this great scene, which I love, is he's standing in front of the Science Council. You know, they're way up high in these seats, you know. And he's like, they're telling him, you know, hey, we see you've applied to the, you know, the Starfleet. That was completely unnecessary. And he says, well, of course it was a backup in case I wasn't admitted. He said, so the council's like, that was completely unnecessary. You know, you've achieved the highest marks and so on and so forth. You've been hereby accepted into the council. And then one of the council members is like, you know, it's amazing that you've come so far and achieved so much given your disadvantage. And he's about to leave, but he can't let it go. And he's like, to what disadvantage are you referring, sir? Your human mother, of course. The camera zooms in on him, and he immediately throws up his berth at the Science Academy and says, I respectfully decline. And it's a great line where it's like, no Vulcan has ever declined. And he's like, well, as I'm half human, your record remains unstained. Live long and prosper. You know, we know he's kind of angry. And it's interesting. So in this moment, this is the new Spock. So JJ does a great job. So we're invested in the character. So it works, right? But in the original series, we were with the character of Spock through the first three seasons. And his journey really was that his emotions were not something that he liked, that he wanted to get rid of them. Part of the juice of Kirk and Spock in general, basically, was that whenever he was in situations where emotions were challenged, like it really was a hard thing for him. And he was always trying to suppress and get away from his feelings, which to me made him a great character because people wanted to get close to him. When he would do small things to show that he cared, like for Kirk or for, you know, Uhura or whatever, it was such a huge dramatic impact in the show, you know? So like, it was just, I feel like that's part of the genius of why characters like Spock and Data work so well, is that obviously Data is the opposite. He's trying to actually be human. But so there's something just about characters that are, you know, self-avowedly like shutting down or saying like, I don't feel, I don't love. And then we come to like them as audience members. And so we're looking for the very slightest chink in their armor for like, if they show even the slightest bit of emotion towards another character. And I feel like it's such a genius setup for an audience to follow a character because, you know, we love the pieces. And the minute they do any small thing that's even related to feelings for other people, like has a huge impact. So that was the original series Spock. And then in the first movie is when his path changed, where he encounters V'ger, and because of his encounter with V'ger, he realizes, you know, that he's kind of was going on the wrong road, and he's like, for all V'gers, you know, V'ger's kind of become what Spock wanted to become, like learn all that is learnable, amass all this knowledge, be a completely rigorous, you know, being of pure thought, and he's like, the simplest human thing is so more complex than all of V'ger. That he was laughing at one point, and he realized that the emotions were vital and complicated. You know, that there was a lot of information to mine from them, and so that kind of changed his tract. So where by the time we get to the Undiscovered Country, when he's counseling Valeris, where it's like, you know, he's kind of counseling her like logic is a means to an end and not an end in itself, and your feelings are very important. So think about that, you know, as a character arc. So, but in here, you know, we're starting off with the new Spock that he is being encouraged, in a sense, by the story. And the writers have set him up as a being that is going to be more interested in following his feelings, right? I mean, he's giving in to his anger with his young friends when his mom is you know, and he bails out on the Vulcan Science Academy because they basically slighted his mom. You know, now Spock as a character is more like he is the Vulcan who embraces his feelings. And later on, obviously, he's in a romantic relationship with Uhura. He's fully on the path already to, like, integrating his feelings with his life. So it's different. I don't think I liked the line at the very end of this scene where he goes, "Live long and prosper." You know, and it was kind of an action movie fuck you line. And I thought, ooh, that's, it was a little, it's just, tonally, it was a little weird for Spock to be so, you know, emotional at that moment of like, you know, screw you, asshole, you trash talk my mom. So I was a little surprised at it. It completely works. I respect the choice that the writers are doing because they completely own it. They put all this time and effort into it, and it becomes part of the thread of the film going forward. To me, this first film is really mostly about Spock, and the second film is kind of about Kirk's journey. So it works, but it was just, I don't know, it's... I don't know if I'm, you know, at the end of the day, I like Spock better when he's trying to repress himself. It's more interesting of a character to when he's like kicking ass and locking and loading, which he's kind of doing in this film. So it is what it is. I don't say it as a negative. It's just more of a personal choice for me for Spock's character. So then we kick over to Earth. We're back in Iowa. We're in a bar following the insanely hot Zoe Saldana as she's kind of threading through this, you know, Iowa bar, basically, haven't changed much in however many hundreds of years have gone by. And as she's ordering drinks from the bar, Kirk is like two people over. And we see Kirk for the first time played by Chris Pine, who I think is really terrific as Kirk. You know, he's flirting like mad with her, trying to get her, you know, whatever he can get from her. And she's very much, you know, resisting it easily, even though she's laughing at some of the things he's saying. There's a moment where she takes him for a hick, but he realizes what a xenolinguistic study is, and he mentions these terms that, you know, would be known only to someone who, you know, has gone to school and learned about it. So, you know, we realize that Kirk's not an idiot, even though he may play one at this moment. So we have this initial brawl. Some of the kind of, you know, meatheads that are in the academy are like, "Is this dude bothering you?" You know, so four of the guys... and Kirk get into this brawl, and, you know, he's holding himself pretty well, and of course they get the better of him and beat the crap out of him. And then Christopher Pike arrives in the person of Bruce Greenwood, who I love, and breaks up the fight. And there's a scene between Christopher Pike and Kirk, which is great. So the bar's empty, and it's him and Pike sitting at this table. Pike's like, "I couldn't believe who you were when the bartender says your name," and he knew his father, George Kirk. So there's this great back and forth where he's like, you know, "What are you doing with your life, man? You know, this is, you want to be the, you know, the living genius for the, you know, the surrounding square miles and who goes nowhere." And Kirk is just like, "What do you want from me, man? Leave me alone," whatever. And there's a great line where Pike says, quote, "Your father was captain of a starship for 12 minutes. He saved 800 lives, including your mother's and yours. I dare you to do better." It's just really great and really sobers Kirk up. Like, you can see he's taking it in. And he's like, "Look, there's a troop ship leaving tomorrow for orbit. You know, be on it. Starfleet needs people like you." And, you know, we really get this sense that Starfleet is in its early, early days still, and that, you know, they're looking for a few good men, as it were. So it's a great scene. I really like it. Bruce Greenwood, just, he's such a great actor. Maybe he's not a great actor, but there's something about Bruce Greenwood's presence in films that I just like. I feel instantly that someone in authority or just an authoritative presence is on board, you know? So it's just great. And then there's a brief scene where Kirk rides on his bike out to the shipyards and we see the Enterprise being constructed on Earth, which it makes great sense thematically because Kirk is looking at the bare bones of the ship that he will come to captain for 5+ years or more. It's great thematically. You know, we get a rising of music. It's nighttime. We focus in on Kirk. His eyes are staring far away, right? It's his destiny. But if you're a sci-fi fan, you know, construction of a ship of that size on the planet, it was ridiculous. There was some trivia bit that I read that they were thinking that they had to construct it on Earth because the way they had to build certain things, you know, that would eventually be in artificial gravity. So they had to build it on Earth where there was real gravity before artificial gravity took over. And I was like, that's hooey. They just needed it there so he can, you know, see it being built and whatever. There's so much goodwill to me built up already in the film and how much they're really hanging on the characters that I'm like, whatevs, you know, it's fine. In the next sequence, we get now Kirk's on the shuttle, and we get the introduction of Leonard McCoy, which is just amazing. I was just so blown away by how great this intro was and how great Carl Urban was. And, you know, he's a little bit older, and he's just been jilted by his wife. And, you know, they go right for the, you know, the origin of the name, Bones, where he's like, you know, my ex-wife, she took the car, the kids, the house. All she left me was my bones, you know. Just awesome. And the fact that, you know, Bones was, in a weird way, in the late 60s, a Sawbones was kind of like, you know, the nickname for like a ship's doctor, like, all right, or doctor, which even dated way before the 60s, like the old Sawbones doctor. So I love that they just updated, but they kept the name and they made it very personal. And Urban's amazing. He's just really funny. He's kind of channeling DeForest Kelly in a way, but he's also making it his own. So can't say enough about how much I love Urban in this. 3 years later, title card. We briefly check in on Nero, you know, waiting around for his revenge. The Narada finally captures Spock. So we see Spock's ship arrive in this time period. He's captured. And then we see Leonard Nimoy, you know, emerge from the ship. And, you know, we're not exactly sure what's going to happen. And he's like, I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to make you watch. So, you know, teasing what's to come with Vulcan. And then we cut back to Starfleet Academy. You know, Kirk is like an upperclassman now. And they bring in the Kobayashi Maru test, which I thought was great. This is kind of a little bit of the plot point that starts it off. But we actually start off with Kirk and a green alien. So obviously from the original series, right, the green alien was an Orion slave girl. So I don't know if in the new series that she's technically an Orion. But anyway, it's kind of funny. They're about to have sex. And, you know, it's Uhura's flatmate, so she comes home. And there's a little bit of a, you know, Zoe Saldana strips. It's an odd thing in this movie in the sequel where, you know, Zoe Saldana strips down in this movie briefly. Does she have to for the story? I don't think so. And then in the sequel, you know, you have Alice Eve as Carol Marcus in that moment where she has to take off her clothes to put on her spacesuit, which, you know, Kirk looks over her shoulder. We get a full-on bikini shot. So, I don't know. They're trying to keep it sexy, but it's odd. The female characters are really good in both films, though, so it's not, like, egregious, but I don't know. It's interesting to note. Let's put it that way. So we get a brief little story bit. It's so fast. If you blink, you miss it. That Uhura was in the long-range sensor array and overheard this Klingon prison planet was attacked and 47 birds of prey were destroyed. And we see Kirk kind of piques Kirk's interest, so we see that he has made note of that. Then here we are at the Kobayashi Maru test, and Uhura kind of thinks he's a dick. She's like, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing you lose yet again tomorrow. So, of course, she's on the bridge as his communications officer, and she's very, like, you know, when he's telling her to do stuff, she's very, like, insolent and, like, really, Kirk? You know, like, there's a great kind of back and forth between them that I really like. You know, during the mission, there's a brief shutdown of everything on the bridge, and it restarts again, obviously, Kirk's, you know, stolen program or something. And it's great. So, you know, everything changes. He blows up all the ships, and everyone's kind of like... and it's the first of him eating this apple, which is something that happens again at the end of the movie, which kind of really is channeling Shatner at that point, for whatever reason. Just kind of reminds me of that. And then they change it here, and then we get this line from this guy behind the glass saying, how the hell did that kid beat your test? And the camera pans over to Spock, who is the author of the Kobayashi Maru test, which is a retcon, is different, you know, from the original series. But I like it. I think it's really clever. And it will, you know, it's great change that will pit them together from the get-go and their philosophies. And they're going to talk about it pretty soon. I thought it was a really good coup of writing, like someone just like, hey, what if it's Spock's test? And it, you know, throws them against each other. So just genius. And then they cut right to the trial. I think it's Tyler Perry who's officiating. And so Kirk's, you know, they're kind of going to cashier him, basically. And he's like, I have the right to face my accuser. And so they start arguing that, like, I think you're just pissed off that I beat your test. And Spock's like, you know, the no-win scenario and death is something every Starship captain must face. You alone, you know, you especially, Cadet Kirk, because of your father. And then Kirk kind of cuts through the bullshit and is like, I think you really don't like that I beat your test. You know, like he's not falling for it, and he doesn't believe in the no-win scenario, which is a great holdover from, you know, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, which where we get this kind of same thing. There's a lot of Khan in this first movie, I think. There's like, to me, Nero is kind of like a Khan light. And the Kobayashi Maru test, you know, so, and the no-win scenario. So they're pulling stuff from Khan big time before they even get to, you know, the second movie where it is kind of Khan. But of course, before, you know, this trial can come to its conclusion, there's an interruption. There's been an attack somewhere. You know, the primary fleet, of course, is engaged somewhere. And so they have to use the Enterprise and the cadets. It's a great last scene before they leave this area where Kirk's like, who is that pointy-eared bastard? And Carl Urban as McCoy is like, I don't know, but I like him. You know, so a really, really great little comedy moment. So Kirk's grounded because of this. He's kind of suspended, so he cannot go up in the, you know, to the mission. And McCoy feels sorry for him, which is kind of the beginning of their friendship. And he, you know, he kind of, you know, good luck, Jim. I'm sure they'll get you back in. Sooner rather than later, and he's walking away. And then we see, you know, Bowen stop and like he comes back. He's like, I'm gonna regret this. Follow me, you know. So, there's this whole thing where he shoots up Kirk with some weird vaccine, which causes all this crazy stuff, you know, and he admits all these symptoms. Blows by the guys on the ground saying, I gotta get him up to the Enterprise sick bay and I'm his doctor and all that. So, really, you know, it's cool. And at the same time, we see that Uhura was initially assigned to the USS Farragut, and her and Spock have this brief little moment back and forth where we get a sense that something's going on between them. We don't know yet. But she's like, I should be assigned to the Enterprise. And he's like, well, you know, it's kind of like the boyfriend who's allowing his girlfriend, you know, to win the argument, right? Where he's like, yes, you should be assigned to the Farragut. My mistake. It's very cute, very brief, you know, and I like it. It's kind of fun.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, it's $4 a week, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi On Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $26 and change right now. At $50 a show, I would really like to improve the quality of the sound for you guys, and I could buy a really good microphone and a booth so you guys can get the best sound I could possibly provide. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/scifionscreen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap, and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, 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 blah.
No, blah, blah, blah.
So great orbital photography and great music cue here, too. Just great setup for the mission. We're seeing all these ships, you know, leave Earth orbit and the starbase, which looks very similar to other starbases, much bigger. A little more robust than we've seen before, but really neat. And also the photography of the city of San Francisco, it's a really beautifully rendered future city. It's like, you know, it's like they took a little bit of Lucas, what Lucas did for some of his cities, but they just made it cooler and more, I don't know, it's a little bit more realistic and impressive. Maybe because they shoot it a little closer. I'm not sure exactly why, but then, of course, we get the reveal of the new Enterprise, which looks great. You know, your basic same setup, but a little bit sleeker. The nacelles have a little bit of a bulge in the front. So she's a little curvier than her predecessors, but, you know, she's all ship. We love the Enterprise. And there's great direction on board. When they first get on board, it's just, it really feels so realistic and busy. Everyone's, like, moving around. I don't know, I just thought it was really great direction on JJ's part of this, you know, ship full of cadets that just got the order to ship out, and everyone's doing something, you know, like there's a really great, believable sense of busyness and realism on the ship when they arrive, which I really like. The bridge is weird. It looks a little breakable to me. Like, it's cool. There's a lot of glass, but it looks kind of fragile in a weird way. So I don't love the bridge, but it's, you know, it looks very cool. Then we have the introduction of John Cho as Sulu, who's great. When they try to leave space dock, the whole fleet warps out. And of course, the Enterprise is left behind, and he's forgotten, you know, as Pike tells him, did you leave the parking brake on? And of course, you know, the parking brake in Trek parlance, as Spock tells him, that he has forgotten the external inertial dampeners, which is great. So he's a replacement pilot, I guess, because of the speed of things. the regular pilot is gone, and so, you know, this is Sulu's arrival, an installation on the Enterprise, as it were. And then we have Chekov, who's sitting right next to him, and Chekov's a really lovable character. When I see it now, after we recently lost Anton Yelchin and the bizarre accident that happened like a week or so ago, it's really, really sad to watch these films and see how winning he was as Chekov and how wonderful and energetic he was as an actor. I mean, God, what a horrible tragedy that was. And he's great here, where they really play up his accent problem. And initially, when he tries to log in sort of the computer with his serial number to make, you know, the shipwide announcement, he can't do it. He has to repronounce the V's because he's pronouncing them as W's. And the announcement over the ship is hysterical in his thick Russian accent. There's also parts in this movie where he says things in Russian, and, you know, if you're Russian, you know what they are, but there are moments when he's exhilarated and he fist pumps him, but he says things in Russian. So it's great. He's a great character, and he's, you know, supposedly Chekov in this universe is this whip smart, you know, 17-year-old who's just kind of really genius. And from his mission brief, we hear about the lightning storm in space around Vulcan. And their mission brief, which now, you know, Kirk being in sick bay, you know, having been gotten on board by McCoy, he hears that. And immediately he knows that, like, now he has to get to the bridge. And this is a lot of great comedy getting him there, because part of what McCoy has done to him, all of a sudden his hands swell up and he can't manipulate things. And then his tongue, he has numb tongue and he can't speak. So it's actually is pretty funny. They do it with such a quick beat. And it's great because he finds Uhura first to confirm that the ship she was monitoring that did the attacking was actually a Romulan ship, and she confirms that it was Romulan. And so he immediately, like, you know, makes a beeline for the bridge. And at this moment, we cut away to the beginning of the drilling sequence on Vulcan and Spock's mother kind of walking out, witnessing this action. Shot really well, you know, lots of Dutch angles. He's like Dutch angle crazy in this movie, but it works really well, I think. You know, we get the great tension. Kirk gets to the bridge. Everyone's like, how'd you get on board? What the hell are you doing? Get this man off the bridge. And him and Spock are kind of going back and forth, and Pike's trying to cut in. And finally, you know, he recounts that this lightning storm in space was the same as when he was born, his father's mission. And then he's able to tell Pike about the Klingon warbirds being destroyed, which he didn't know about. And then Uhura being now on the bridge, she confirms it, which is just great. So this is a great moment of, like, you know, Kirk has his moment. And Spock being such a likable character, even though, you know, he's very much anti-Kirk at this point, he has the line, the cadet's logic is sound. So he accepts Kirk's reading of the situation, you know, which is kind of neat. And so when they arrive, you know, they're ready for anything, and the shields are up, and they arrive in this wonderful, you know, it made me think of when the Falcon arrived around Alderaan with all the asteroids. They arrive in this graveyard of, like, all these ships that were destroyed the minute they arrived on Vulcan. It's really cool, and they got to duck in and around the, you know, the ships as they're kind of careening around. It's a really neat, beautifully shot. All the space sequences in the movie are really well shot. So Nero's about to destroy the Enterprise when he sees the call sign 17701, and he stops, and he knows Spock, which is weird because, you know, Spock doesn't know him. But he wants Pike on board the Narada for negotiations. So very similar to the prologue where he takes the captain on board. So Pike's strategy now is he has Kirk walk with him. He promotes Kirk to first officer. He makes Spock in command, and the plot now will be that the drill they've lowered is creating this static, which doesn't allow them to beam anywhere and disrupts communication. So they're going to space jump, disable the drill, which will allow them to be beamed back aboard, and which will allow, you know, the Enterprise to alert the rest of the fleet. So really great in that, you know, we get Kirk's immediate promotion to first officer, and Spock's put in command, setting things up for what's going to happen later. And of course, the great in-joke for Trek fans is it's Sulu and Kirk and a red shirt. So, and we all know what's going to happen to the red shirt when it reaches the drill. So kind of funny that they're, you know, they're playing with Trek lore here in a really great way. Then there's a brief, you know, plot point where they're using this red matter, which we don't know much about yet. They take this tiny drop of it and suspend it in some liquid, and they put it in this device, which they're going to introduce into the Vulcan. You know, I guess they're drilling this tunnel all the way to the center of Vulcan, and they're going to drop this thing all the way down, and we still don't know what's going to happen yet. So they space jump, you know, on the way down. They're talking about, you know, what kind of combat training everybody has, and Kirk asks Sulu, and he's like, fencing, you know, it's great. And the drop is initially silent, which is great. Again, another great sonic transition. Really great photography. The camera is just everywhere, and it really looks wonderful. And I think Olsen is the red shirt. Of course, he tries to hot dog it by pulling his chute really at the last minute, and of course gets, you know, right into the drill flame and is dead. Kirk and Sulu get into the platform. It's good old-fashioned hand-to-hand combat. Sulu's sword kind of extends from nothing, you know? It's kind of like a weird molecular, you know, construction of his sword, and he's fighting a Klingon with a similar weapon, and Kirk's doing hand-to-hand with another Romulan, I should say, not Klingon. So, of course, they win. They disable the drill, but it's too late, and this wonderful device that the red matter is introduced into the planet's core is this like shuttlecock probe that's like once it drops it just spins to slow it down and it just shoots all the way down, which is really neat. Chekhov has to beam them up because they fall off the drill, and so they're, you know, there's this last minute action movie kind of thing where they're about to smash into the planet, and Chekhov runs down to the transporter room because he can, you know, the regular transporter chief can't beam them because they're moving too fast, but Chekhov knows how to do it. So we're getting the sense that he's kind of this whiz kid. So he runs out. It's like a last-minute action set piece, which is, you know, it's good. At the same time, Spock then beams down to Vulcan to go to this, you know, this place to get his family out where they kind of, you know, when the planet's in jeopardy, the Vulcan high leaders will go to this one place where most of their culture is. And so he almost gets them all out. His mother slips because the rocks, there's seismic anomalies throughout the planet. And just as they're beaming out, his mother turns and looks at him and slips away. And it's a punch in the gut for the movie, I have to say, because you've been emotionally with Spock since the beginning. And he has such a close relationship with his mother, and she means so much to him, and he's so protective of her. And it's such a credit for the writers to get me there, that when I look at Spock looking at the empty platform, and I look at his father looking at him, like, it really hits me. And it makes the destruction of Vulcan a much more personal tragedy, except, you know, some kind of Roland Emmerich, you know, disaster thing of like, wow, look, a planet just got eaten. In a sense, you know, the death of Vulcan is the death of Spock's mother. They're intertwined thematically. So the death of it, plus when we talk to old Spock later, it really makes the loss of Vulcan like quite a palpable thing in the universe of Trek. And it was quite a move for the writers to do, and I'm sure they were afraid of fan backlash, but I think it was really great. I think it gave things stakes, and it made the movie feel a little more at risk, you know, than sometimes these movies can feel. So I think they did a good job with that. So briefly afterwards, you know, Spock is still in command in the Enterprise, and he's speaking in the log, and 6 billion Vulcans died, and there are only 10,000 left in the galaxy, and he has the line, "I'm suddenly the member of an endangered species," which is amazing. And there's a great scene between him and Uhura in the turbo lift, where she knows that he's just like a mess, and she runs in, and they close the door, and she's like, "What do you need? What do you need?" It's a beautiful scene, you know, very, very, very Abramsy to me, you know, like he can do some of these scenes, these brief emotional touch points between couples, you know, really well, you know. So, you know, she hugs him, and there's this moment when he just kind of bows his head and touches her shoulder, when he just gives in a little bit to her, and then straightens right back up again to be, you know, because he's in command of the ship. So very subtle, but very well done. So then a brief cut to the Narada. We have Captain Pike now being tortured, and they're taking another thing from Wrath of Khan, you know, which is the eels, the little creatures that wound into the ears. But of course, in this movie, it's through Pike's mouth. You know, we hear a little bit about Nero's backstory here, and it's really here when I'm kind of like, I don't think Nero is really interesting at all. He's really, really uninteresting. He's just kind of a generator for the story, and there's not much to him. You know, a miner who's, you know, he wants to destroy the entire Federation because, you know, Spock's well-meaning attempt to save his planet failed. You know what I mean? It's like, and he's going on to blame an alien from the Federation who didn't make it in time to save his planet. You know, like, it just, to me, it's the absurdity at the core of this whole movie. I think it's a credit to the movie how well it's done that it doesn't really drag on the movie, but whenever you're kind of square on to Nero, it's like, dude, who cares? Like, get over it, you know, give me a break. This is ridiculous. So they're wise to keep Nero very, very low profile because, you know, not much there, really. On the Enterprise now, they're, you know, they're strategizing. They're talking about red matter, and they know now that, you know, the weapon is a black hole. There's there's a line from Bones where he's like, "I'm a doctor, man, not a physicist." And Spock kind of makes a little bit of a leap of judgment for the story, not so much realistically, that conceivably with such technology that you could create a hole in space-time, not just create black holes, and it's possible that this technology has come via, you know, the future, basically. So Spock and Kirk are now arguing what's the next thing to do. And Spock now here lays out the JJ verse, like in a sense, the Narada has gone back in time and has changed all of their lives and all of their destinies, you know? And so if you're in the movie and you're paying attention, you're really getting the writers speaking to the audience saying, okay, look, you know, we kind of figured out this clever way to leave the original series that you all know and love alone. And yet at the same time, you know, exist in the same universe with the same characters, same situations, a lot of the same people, and do what kind of we want to do and create a new timeline. I think it's really genius to me that you're rebooting a movie, but leaving the original continuity in place. Not only that, you're bringing part of that continuity into this new space-time continuum in the guise of old Spock, you know? So probably the most brilliant, you know, rebooting of a franchise I've ever seen, and that it allows the original to continue and be part of what is a driver that creates this new. So just nuts. I don't know who the hell came up with that, but man, a genius move by the writers. So, of course, you know, Kirk will not back down. He wants to take the ship in pursuit of the Narada, which is now headed for Earth to do the same thing. Spock wants to kind of, you know, be cautious and head to the Laurentian system and reunite with the rest of the fleet and kind of, you know, because the ship is so powerful. And at one point, he's battling with the guards, and Spock does the neck pinch, which is great, and he's like, get him off my ship. And so he's ejected to this small moon called Delta Vega, which is a Federation outpost not far from Vulcan. So this whole sequence on Delta Vega is one big coincidence that's a little tough to swallow. I don't like the monster, you know. This is very Star Wars that he crash lands there and he gets out and there's this creature there chasing him, very much like Hoth, the ice creature, and Luke, you know, and kind of the Rancor all wrapped into one creature. So I thought it was very Star Wars. I didn't really love it. And, you know, highly improbable that he would land somewhere near this cave where Spock is. Like, you really have to swallow it. And I do, because the movie's like, it's being done so well that, you know, and you can't wait for these characters to get together, that I swallow it. But, it is really, really a highly improbable thing. And I'd wish, in a weird way, Spock was on the... They had put Spock with Scotty on the, you know, at the outpost where he was there, kind of nursing his wounds. And then Kirk makes his way there because that's where he's going to get picked up, and that's where he bumps into Spock. But again, you know, then you're going to have, dramatically, that's a tough sell, because you're going to have the dramatic reveal of Spock, but you're also going to have the dramatic reveal of Scotty. So it's a little, it's too much at once. So I hear what they were doing, but it's still a little bit to swallow. Now we get the more of the Nero backstory, and it's clever. They do a flashback visually via the Vulcan mind meld. So we see the whole story about Ambassador Spock, and Romulus was in danger of an exploding star. There's a dumb line in here that they missed, that a star was, you know, threatening the entire galaxy. Like, I don't think any star has the power going supernova to threaten the whole galaxy. So, goofy little line, but it was threatening Romulus. And so, you know, Spock's not in time to save Romulus, even though he does use the red matter to kind of swallow the star before it, you know, does any more damage. But, you know, Nero is there, intercepts him. They're both pulled into this new black hole, Nero first, and Spock like seconds later. But, you know, in those seconds, you know, basically decades go by. So kind of cool. And then when he waits for Spock, he beamed him to Delta Vega to watch the destruction of Vulcan, which he just did. So it's kind of nice, because it gives Kirk a bit of our old future, and then he knows in some sense that they, you know, Spock becomes his best friend, and he's the one now who kind of wants to draw closer to Spock. And there's a couple of lines later where he says things like, "See, we're getting along already." Where he knows that they become great friends, so he doesn't give in to his animosity of not liking Spock. He realizes that, you know, their differences are going to actually make them great friends. So it's kind of neat. And also, you know, Kirk's asking Spock, did I know my father? And he said, in my timeline, you know, your father saw you graduate to the academy and take command of the Enterprise, and he couldn't be more proud of you. So, you know, he gets kind of hit with this alternate, you know, past, really, where his father was there throughout the whole thing. And, you know, but that in a sense, he is still following kind of his destiny, regardless, to become a starship captain. So it's kind of interesting. Then we briefly cut back to the Enterprise, where there's this scene between McCoy and Spock, where Spock kind of takes him aside and he says, "Listen, you know, I appreciate that you supported me earlier in terms of what happened with Kirk. I'm sure that couldn't have been easy." And he's like, "Can I speak off the record?" He's like, You know, and then he's doing all this McCoy stuff like, damn it, man, you don't send your prize stallion down, you know, away right before the race, blah, blah, blah. So they're arguing back and forth. And then, of course, this is the beginning of the McCoy-Spock rivalry of where when Spock leaves, McCoy's like green-blooded hobgoblin. So it's great that they're setting up this this troika of characters and how they interact together, you know. So then we get a great, you know, we get to the outpost. We get the arrival of Scotty. We don't really know why he's ended up here. In terms of not being, you know, on the Enterprise as an engineer, you know, from the beginning. Supposedly, he tried to do something and failed at it. He transported the dog of, like, a high-ranking official somewhere and was exiled. So, but they don't say why he did, if he did what he did, was it related to the arrival of the Narada, you know? But it's just one of those things where this universe is different. You know, Scotty's character is somehow a little different as well. And Simon Pegg is great because this Scotty is a little more comical than the original Scotty. And I think rightly so. I think it's a nice little, they just kind of salt it a little differently and make Scotty really a comic relief figure, which is I think is really great. And then we're introduced to transwarp beaming, which is little Star Trek 4 here, where they're like, maybe you invented the thing anyway. Here are your core, you know. You know, they're bringing in more of the original series films, which is kind of cool. You know, it's fine. It's a hell of a stretch to get them back on the ship, but whatever. You know, it is what it is. And then they do more character development, and Spock is talking to Kirk, and he's saying, listen, you know, you have to get me to show the fact that I'm emotionally compromised. But it's really sketchy that Spock's like, you know, you have to recommend. You have to retake command of the ship. It's the only way that this is going to work out well. It's like it's a little sketchy, but you know, whatever. He's like, you know, I can tell you, Jim. I just saw the destruction of my world, and that I am emotionally compromised. So pretty interesting. And then he's, you know, kind of giving Kirk the license to like, you've got to manipulate me into showing it, and then take command of the ship yourself. And I like to mention here. I mean, it's been done earlier, but I like the new transporter visuals. It's almost as if when you're transported, you're surrounded by these parallel points of light that start spinning around you. I just think it's a really cool choice in terms of the transporter effect. So really neat. They arrive back on the Enterprise. There's a little bit of a, you know, action movie dramatic where Scotty gets transported into a cooling vent and Kirk has to, you know, find a way to open it up before he gets chewed up by some pump. Whatever. Very Star Wars again to me. And they're caught by the guy who he got into a fight with back on Earth. And back on Earth, he had called him Cupcake. And of course, the guard now is like, come with me, Cupcake. You know, so get a little tag there. It's kind of fun. And then we have you immediately into the scene where Kirk is trying his best to get Spock to kind of lose his shit. And he's not doing a great job, of course, until he mentions his mother and says, you never loved her. Spock just goes to town on him and completely takes him down, and he's about to choke him to death. And you know, the weird thing is nobody's doing anything about it. It's a little much, as JJ will do, like no one else is trying to stop him, not even Uhura. And he's really kind of got Kirk almost dead, and his father is the one who has to actually open his mouth. But he immediately relinquishes command, and Kirk is now captain. And I like that there's a moment where Uhura walks up to him and she's like, I hope you know what you're doing. And he's not gloating and confident and cocky about what just happened, but he's almost apologetic to her. Like, you know, I hope so too. Like he wasn't happy about what he did, but he felt in his capacity as an officer that it was necessary. So just, again, a very subtle, but if he was cocky with Uhura right here, I think it would have been a wrong beat. Would have just kind of felt wrong, you know. But I don't know, just again, JJ has a very sure touch on some of the characters in this film. And it's actually clear here, too, if you're watching the film, that at this moment, it's Kirk's drive and gut instincts that make him a better leader. Not maybe not a better officer, but a better leader. And that, you know, Spock is maybe the better, more sound officer. But in this moment, Kirk's the one who's going to inspire people to follow him and to get the job done. And it's done in the movie. Like, it, you know, we don't have to have a character commenting like, wow, Kirk's really a better leader or whatever. Like, you can feel it and kind of see it in this very moment, which is really neat. So then we have the bookmark conversation between Spock and his dad, which kind of, you know, echoes what had happened earlier in the film. It's a wonderful scene, and his father tells him how proud he is of him and that he's so grateful that he's half human. And Spock admits how angry he is, and his father said, you know, if mother was alive, she would say, don't fight it. And he said, you know, I was wrong about what I told you earlier. I didn't marry your mother because it was a logical thing to do. I married her because I loved her. You know, so this is the whole different arc for Spock, where even his Vulcan father, they're all pushing him towards embracing his human side and not fighting it, you know. So, but it's a beautiful scene, really great for Spock's character. So he comes right back out, he's kind of healed, you know, and we've done the very convenient twist now where he, you know, he's the first officer and, you know, under Kirk. And as they plan this out, everyone's involved. Chekhov comes up with the idea of coming out of hyperspace around Saturn to mask them. Scotty can tweak the engines to get them there soon. Spock is very clear-headed and logically explains to Kirk why, since he looks more Romulan, he'd be best to be the one to go to the Narada. Great back and forth between the two of them. There's a moment where Spock's like, I will cite certain regulations, but I know you will simply ignore them. You know, like very, very great Kirk and Spock. And really impressive in that, you know, they found the tone between Kirk and Spock with these two new actors in this new reboot, you know, very quickly and very surely. I'm very impressed with that, actually. And here's where Kirk has the line, see, we are getting to know one another. And, you know, Spock's kind of surprised at that. He doesn't quite understand it yet. Right before Kirk and Spock beam over to the Narada, you know, Uhura comes up to Spock and hugs him, and he hears her first name, which has been kind of an in-joke in the film as he's been trying to learn it the whole way. When he finally does learn it, he also learns that, you know, she's with Spock. So very cute. So they transport. There's a funny joke where Scotty's like, if the ship is set up the way I think it is, you're going to transport it to this place where no one, you know, there won't be a soul in sight. Of course, they transport almost onto the bridge, surrounded by Romulans, and there's a battle right away. What's great here, this little detail, is that they stun most of the Romulans down, and Spock mind melds with one of the Romulans and gets the info about where to find the red matter and where Christopher Pike is, which, you know, this is the kind of thing in these kind of movies where, you know, if you're a fan like me, you kind of just swallow it, where, you know, anytime people beam into like a Death Star or somewhere else, like they always just very easily figure out where to go. Like, oh, there's the princess's, you know, here's some plans, you know, like you'd be anywhere able to figure out where the hell all this stuff is on this completely alien ship if you mind meld with someone who knows the ship, you know. So I thought it was like an earnest attempt by the writers to like circumvent a lot of the things that we take for granted, we who watch these films. So I don't know, I thought it was kind of cool. So they find the ship that old Spock came in and recognizes young Spock. You know, young Spock is like curious, Kirk. He knows Kirk knows something, but he won't push it, you know, at the moment. And Kirk's like, oh, that's weird. You know, funny little beat. And we get the time travel plot. Young Spock, obviously very smart, gets it right away, takes the ship out of the Narada, uses it to take out the drill. So pretty much Earth is in pretty good shape at this point. Kirk finds Nero. He gets his butt beat half to death. And then Nero, when he realizes Spock is, you know, taking the ship, he bails. And Kirk winds up killing the lieutenant in a battle, which is whatever. The hand-to-hand's okay in this. And now Spock's heading straight towards the Narada, kind of very much bookending like the beginning of the movie where he's going to do collision course. The Narada fires like every weapon it has, and it's heading towards Spock's ship. But of course, the Enterprise now in a Han Solo moment arrives, takes out all the weapons, beams Spock out. Kirk gets Christopher Pike. He's beamed out, and they both kind of appear back on the transporter pads the same moment, which is kind of neat. At that point, the Red Matter ship is creating this massive black hole. It's pulling the Narada in. And there's this scene where Kirk says, we're willing to render assistance to your ship. You know, you're not going to escape. Spock's like, Captain, what are you doing? And he's like, show them mercy and compassion, Spock. You know, maybe they'll come around. I thought you'd like it. It's logical. And Spock's like, not this time. And I didn't like that as an old Trek fan because that's, you know, Spock is kind of like being, obviously he's more in tune with his emotions. He's a little too gung-ho for me. And it's like, obviously he's feeling more feelings now and he wants revenge and that's part of his character. And I get that. And the movie earns it completely. But as a Trek fan, you know, the ethos of Trek and Roddenberry's vision of, you know, not just a bunch of guys out there with laser guns, that there's kind of a moral rectitude to what goes on in the Star Trek universe. And when I hear statements like that, I know that the writers are kind of throwing that aside and really just kind of playing up the action adventure aspects of it. And because they do the characters so well, it's completely okay. But as a Trek fan, it bugged me. So then, of course, this is a last-minute jeopardy after the Narada is destroyed. The Enterprise barely can get out, and it, you know, it blows up. It ejects the warp core, and escapes, you know, it's kind of fun. So whatever, your last minute action adventure trope. We're back with Starfleet Academy now, the Coda. Spock is talking with his older self. It's okay, you know, like, again, the older Spock, having come full circle in his journey, is now, you know, coaching his younger self to, like, embrace emotions. And that's, again, part of his new journey for sure. So that's tied off. And there's an award ceremony where Kirk is given his first commendation and he's awarded the Enterprise. We see Pike in a wheelchair, which is a brief nod to the original series when I think it was the Menagerie or the Cage. It was actually the Menagerie where I think we see Pike in this crazy wheelchair in the two-part episode. So that's kind of a nod to that, which I like. And they end on the bridge with Kirk eating an apple again. Spock officially becomes his first officer. And we're out. Then we get the original Alexander Courage theme and a brief Nimoy voiceover as we go to end credits. So brief summary. Now, I said most of what I want to say about the film as I went, but I really liked it. I really liked it because they really spent great time getting the characters right. I don't think they missed a beat with any of the characters. I mean, Uhura was great. Scotty was great. Bones, Kirk and Spock were really good. You know, Spock a little bit different, but still great. I respect the choice of the writers. Nero as a villain was just who cared? Nobody cared. Sulu and Chekhov, terrific. Like, to me, there wasn't a false note character-wise. And because the writing was so fun between all these characters, like, I swallowed, you know, some of the logic of the Delta Vega and of Nero being this ridiculous character and, you know, stuff like that. And it was just a great ride. And while it didn't really get into the ethos of Trek, which to me makes Trek more than just your basic shoot 'em up, the depth of character, to me, that they spent time on made up for that in some ways. I can rewatch this movie over and over again. Like, to me, I like it better than even a lot of the original series movies. It's just so well done, and it's so much fun, and it's shot so well. I don't think J.J. has been better as an actual action movie director than this film. I don't think Into Darkness is shot nearly as well as this. There's something so incredibly immediate and powerful about everything that he's shooting, how things are 3D all around the frame. So just amazing all around. So I think it's really good film. I really like it a lot. Let's go to some trivia. So a little bit of trivia about this film. Simon Pegg didn't audition for the part. He simply received an email from J.J. Abrams asking if he'd like to play Scotty. Pegg said that he would have done it for free or even paid Abrams to be in the movie if he wasn't offered a part. When Chris Pine was cast as James Kirk, he sent William Shatner a letter and received a reply containing Shatner's approval. The sound of the automatic doors opening on the Enterprise is a Russian train's toilet flushing. Figure that one out. There's a feature film debut of Chris Hemsworth, who played George Kirk. Didn't know that. First role on screen. And the apple that Kirk is eating is also an apple he is eating in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan when he's relating to the rest of them when they're in that cave about the Kobayashi Maru test. According to director J.J. Abrams in the commentary, this was not intended to be a reference to Khan. He was simply told at one point that lead actors seem cocky eating apples. It's kind of funny. So Roberto Orci, Alex Kurtzman, and J.J. Abrams personally called upon Nimoy's home to request for his role in the film. According to Orci, the actor gave a, quote, "who are you guys and what are you up to" manner, end quote, before being told how important he was to them. He was silent, and Nimoy's wife, Susan Bay, told the creative team that after their conversation, he had remained in his chair, emotionally overwhelmed by his decision to return as Spock after turning down many opportunities to revisit the role. He decided to act in the film as he was turned on by the script's scope and its detailing of the characters' histories. Quote, "we have dealt with Spock being half-human, half-Vulcan, but never with quite the overview that this script has of the character's entire history, his character growth, his beginnings, and his arrival into the Enterprise crew," end quote. When Chekhov manages to transport Sulu and Kirk aboard from a fall, he shouts, "yo moyo," which is a Russian exclamation of surprise and excitement, roughly corresponding to English "hot damn," which is great, actually. So the Korean-American actor John Cho was initially uncertain about being cast as the Japanese-American officer Hikaru Sulu, but George Takei, who played Sulu in Star Trek, encouraged him to take the role, as Sulu was a character who represented all of Asia. When Cameron Crowe saw a rough cut of the film, he kept asking who played the villain. He was staggered to realize that it was the unrecognizable Eric Bana. The first time Zachary Quinto met Leonard Nimoy in the set, Nimoy said to the young actor, quote, "You have no idea what you're in for," end quote. And they used Majel Barrett's voice for the Enterprise computer, as she's been the voice for most of the computers in most of the series. Will Wheaton recorded dialogue for many of the Romulans on Nero's ship, although his voice was digitally altered. And this echoes what I was saying earlier. McCoy refers to his divorce, saying all his wife left him was his bones, suggesting that is where his nickname comes from. In fact, in the 19th century, doctors were often called sawbones due to their unpleasant duty of amputating injured limbs. While most Trekkies will have known this detail for decades, this is the first time that Uhura has been given a first name on screen, Nyota. Roddenberry never came up with a first name for her while Star Trek was in production. A few years later, someone pointed out to him that Nyota is the Swahili word for star, and the name Nyota Uhura is often used in printed Star Trek literature, including the DC Comics publication Who's Who in Star Trek. McCoy mentions joining Starfleet after his divorce. This refers to a DC Fontana backstory for McCoy written for the third season but never filmed. That unused subplot established this failed marriage and also McCoy's daughter, Joanna. The outdoor scene on Vulcan viewed by Spock's mother is based on multiple repetitions of the iconic profile of the Vasquez Rocks National Park area just north of Los Angeles along State Highway 14. The rocks have a highly recognizable weathered peak that rises at a 45-degree angle to the horizon. 9 episodes of the original series, including Shore Leave, Arena, The Alternative Factor, and Friday's Child, had scenes filmed in this area. And if you're a Star Trek fan, you know exactly the rock formation we're talking about. And that's about all the trivia I got, and that's pretty much all I've got to say about Star Trek. I'll see you next time.